every day I read the NASCAR report of all the crashes that had happened before, the day before. Everything on autopilot, everything in Silicon Valley, in San Francisco with Google and Waymo, et cetera, et cetera. After a year of doing that, I needed to take a break. I needed to go because, you know, there's nothing like reading all these crashes. I am actually taking the bus a lot more than I ever have. Hello, and welcome to the Autonocast. I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
I'm Alex Roy, the founder of the Human Driving Association and co-founder of the finest strategic consultancy in transportation, Johnson & Roy.
And I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors. And boy, I am so excited for this episode. We have a returning guest. A guest who I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar, certainly our longer listening ones. And I'm so excited. I'm just going to stop and let Alex weigh in here on the first question here, because he's clearly as excited as I am.
Do we have a name, Ed? Who's here?
Veteran fighter pilot and the most honest person in potential regulation of automated driving, Professor Missy Cummings.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, Alex, welcome to the Autonocast.
Professor Cummings, what car do you drive daily? And can you tell us how you feel about its driver assistance system?
So I'm driving an 11-year-old Ford Escape that has cruise control. That's about it. Because I have a 17-year-old in the house, I'm just waiting for her to crash it so that I can get a new one.
A new Ford Escape?
No, something new. I'm not sure yet what that's going to be.
So actually, I want to jump in, Alex, because I think we should follow this thread just a little longer, because you have the very serious voice on right now. Let's keep it light for a minute. So when you think about the new cars on the market, though, because obviously you have extreme interest in automated driving and there's all sorts of marketing around it, like what, not just what are you looking for, but what do you want to avoid? Like, what are the systems that are just very unappealing to you because of their safety issues?
Yeah, nothing with any driver assist, for sure.
So you'll be buying an older used vehicle then? Like, you wouldn't buy a new vehicle?
By driver assist, I mean the convenience features. Nothing with lateral or longitudinal control. You know, I want the AEB. I want all the, you know, warnings, all the safety technologies. But, you know, I've lately been doing a lot of expert witness consulting, not just against Tesla, but many other companies. And, you know, the other day I was on the phone with a man he gave his 16-year-old son a Tesla for his birthday, and he was dead 2 weeks later. And it's just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because people don't really appreciate how much you have to pay attention with these technologies. And it's not just a Tesla problem. I warned everyone about this. Now you're seeing Blue Cruise, Super Cruise, other technologies kind of get caught up in this. And so I think we're at a real crossroads. Is lateral and longitudinal control driving assist features in your car? Should you even have them?
So I'm curious. I think a lot of our conversation today will be about sort of where some of the lines are in terms of some of these technologies. And I'm just curious, from a purely subjective, experiential perspective, I feel like adaptive cruise control is like the limit for me in terms of something that I feel like I can deal with it, right? Like I get some benefit. Like I don't think it's huge. I do lots of long trips without it. But I see some benefit to it, but it doesn't feel like it crosses me over that line where I'm like too disengaged from the thing, but it's a purely subjective thing. I haven't obviously done like serious, you know, study of this. Do you feel like, you know, adaptive cruise control is just as bad as adaptive cruise control, or the combination of the two, or are there some degrees or lines here where you would draw sort of a line?
No, I mean, that's where I draw the line. I think ACC is fine, okay. But anything beyond ACC, and I think the literature is starting to become quite clear on this. It's when you take the act of steering away from the human that they really start to check out. So that's why I didn't say longitudinal control, it's lateral and longitudinal control.
Mm. Okay. It's cool that my sort of intuitive sense of that kind of matches what your research finds.
The interesting thing to me about once you give up the steering control. So, you know, I've tested a lot of these systems, is not just checking out potentially, but also how the vehicle reacts when it disengages, which I think that a beginner driver would really struggle with. You see this with like Tesla vehicles, when if you hit that torque on the steering, the way it disengages, it actually moves the vehicle a little bit. And a new driver in particular, or one who hasn't been paying attention but then is surprised by that movement, I could see many people overcorrecting. Are you like potentially overcorrecting and then either crashing or losing control in some way? Are you finding that at all, that's kind of what's been happening as you look at some of these crashes?
For sure. Or is it
something else?
Yeah, it's the most common accident profile I see. And it's not just me. That was this problem with the inadvertent disconnect and over-controlling of steering has showed up in the recent NHTSA recall of Tesla. I mean, they very clearly outline that problem.
So in 2016, I did what I think was one of the earliest like journalist reviews, comparisons of like Super Cruise versus Autopilot. And it was very clear to me then that there needed to be some standardization of transitions, you know, from on to off, like basically a transition management system with some like best practices or industry standard around the length of time required for notification for takeovers, and then the method of that takeover. And I remember poking around Silicon Valley and talking to some OEMs saying, this would be a good idea. Like, we should land on like 45 or 60 seconds notice before takeover. And prior to that takeover, the manufacturer has to have liability, or this is all a joke. Like, this is not safe. I've seen zero motion forward on standardizing, you know, a handover time interval. And on the liability front, no forward progress. And I know Mercedes is kind of, you know, made some statements that they walked back. Do you have a point of view on the transitions, the handovers, and if it's even possible to pick a time interval and that would improve safety?
Well, I just want to be clear then that we've moved from level two driving assist and from that conversation over to level three, where the driver is theoretically able to disconnect and do other things. And then how long would that transition take? And, you know, I would agree with you that a reasonable time to expect would be, you know, at a minimum 30 seconds. But like you said, 45, 60 seconds would be a lot more reasonable. The problem is a lot of really bad things can happen in 0.3 seconds, much less 30 seconds. And I don't, you know, this thing with Mercedes and their level three, I hate to be a lurker on this one, but I'm just waiting and watching for what's going to happen. I can't imagine that this is, because they haven't specified very clearly how this is going to happen and, you know, to what degrees of uncertainty can the system tolerate. And so I think this is one where we're going to have to watch the NHTSA standing general order to see what's happening.
You have made statements about... I think you made statements about how like end-to-end neural nets could never resolve, or it would be a very long, the long tail of edge cases, and that they're fundamentally flawed. Recently, Wave AI last week announced a $1 billion raise and for these end-to-end neural net solutions. But they use cameras and radar. And it seems like the excitement in automated driving has moved from like vertical robotaxi business models now to end-to-end neural nets. Do you think that's ever resolvable? Can they actually be safe?
No. I mean, it's not even safe is unquestionably not. Will it even just work, you know, well enough outside, you know, very narrow demonstrations? No, it just can't work. You can't, there is no end-to-end neural networks. If you want to see a good example of end-to-end neural nets in your daily life, just look at how well all these large language models are working or not. And that's, that's effectively what those are. And they can't do it, and which is why they've had to start augment them with GoFi, good old-fashioned AI, and or attach them to other tools because they simply can't do it. So it's just a pipe dream, but it sounds good.
I'm so glad you brought up LLMs because I've been doing some work in robotic construction and warehouse robotics recently. And in construction and robotics, you have very clearly defined operational design domains. And, you know, they're pre-mapped, everything is known. It's a bit of a relief to not have to tell clients that they're going down a potentially dangerous path. And yet, there was a tweet last week from our friend George Hotz, your friend. And he said, humanoid robots run by, end-to-end neural nets are the full self-driving level 5 of interior robotics. It's never going to work. What a scam. So,
well, he was trolling Kyle Vogt, to be clear. Like, yeah, that was a troll.
But the Kyle Vogt announcement of the bot company and interior, helper bots comes in the wake of two other big things, which is Elon Musk's, Optimus and Figure, which is a guy named Brett Adcock, who comes out of eVTOL, who has, raised $600 million for humanoid robots. Do you have a point of view on humanoid robots? In the context of them being operated by LLMs or operated by end-to-end neural nets, and is HOTS right? Are they the full self-driving level 5 of interior robots?
I mean, yes, generally. I teach a class in human robot interaction, so tune in the fall if you want to see what that's all about. But look, humanoid robots, they work well in very limited settings, very controlled settings. But the problem with the humanoid robots is basically the problem with driving everywhere all the time. No neural net, no computer vision, no planning system can handle that level of uncertainty. And so if you have a bot, that just flips burgers in a McDonald's all day long, okay, that's very task specific and they can be pretty good at that. But the instant you tell the bot to flip burgers and then turn around and wash dishes, it's a whole new ball game. And wash dishes with, at two different kinds of sinks, it would be completely different. And so I'm not saying that we can never have bots do these jobs, but for the foreseeable future, bots, humanoid robots, are only going to be able to work in the very narrow domains that they're built for and trained for.
Yeah. And I think the similarity, right, with full self-driving, it's like we were discussing in our last episode, right? It's the investors love the idea of these general purpose thing, right? You're going to create a general solution that will automate whatever you want it to automate. Like, that is just absolute catnip for investors. But practitioners know robots look like the job that they do, right? And for the most part, humanoid robots, the job that they do is raise money, right?
And so, raise money they do. But there is clearly a purpose for a very task specific robot, I think, back to your point. And you see some real potential there in maybe dangerous environments or, handling even hazardous materials or something like that, but it's very task specific. And then you have to look at what's the payout for that? Is it about safety and keeping human beings out of dangerous situations? And what is the cost of doing that? Because it seems like a lot of the folks who are interested in humanoid robots, then it becomes are they now taking jobs? Is this really a safety specific endeavor? Or is it just that they don't want to pay humans? And I don't really know what the savings is there. It's not really proven out quite yet, just because the cost of building a humanoid robot to do one specific task when a human could do multiple tasks in the same sort of environs just doesn't seem played out yet. Maybe we'll get there, I don't know, in a couple decades where these robots can do multiple tasks.
I think the thing that concerns me about where we are with large language models is that it has introduced a whole new level of insanity coast to coast, worldwide, that now people think that we've got general intelligence robots. And my latest third rail is people who try to bring in LLMs into self-driving car control. So that's a big one. And so I think that there's just, you know, massive ignorance about what LLMs can and can't do. What does it mean to have general intelligence? And the more that people believe this, and the more that people like Sam Altman continue to push a really ill-informed and, you know, I think he's pushing a very manipulative message. The problem is that the real research that we need in robotics to really push things forward is not going to happen.
Because of the distraction on...
Right, because this is a huge distraction. And while everybody, every Tom, Dick, and Harry roboticist, I would say, you know, a armchair roboticist thinks that they now have a tool to do, you know, general intelligence, and all they have to do is connect an LLM to Pepper the robot, and now we've got something amazing. But it's actually would be worse than whatever you had before.
Real quick, I just wanted to ask in terms of LLMs, what is your thinking though around this recent trend, I guess we can call it, aside from the eye rolling of car makers putting LLMs or touting, you know, these a ChatGPT like assistant in regular vehicles. So Mercedes is doing this. Volkswagen has played around with it, which is hilarious since their general software isn't really great.
I wish the audience could see Professor's face as you're speaking, but go on.
So I mean, aside from the, we all kind of think it's like, obviously silly, but is there actually a danger factor here or something that beyond being useless that this can introduce by putting it into not having it control anything, just providing information to the driver or passenger?
Yeah. So I'm doing research right now on how LLMs are used to deceive people. And it's bad. And so there's a huge amount of vulnerability in any application of these LLMs. But you can imagine, even if it's not hooked to the control system, let's just say it's hooked to, you know, where to find a cup of coffee. Where's the nearest Starbucks or what have you? You know, that information can be so easily manipulated so that, you know, in a best case that you would just be get sent to a Starbucks that actually paid money to get a preferential assignment, all the way to you could get sent to an address that is specifically one where you're going to get mugged or carjacked or what have you. And so these, the LLMs are unbelievably vulnerable to hacking behavior. And so I think that presents a clear and present danger.
Can you explain a little bit more about like, how is it so open to, is it because that's such large amounts of data, it's hard to trace the original source of everything. And so it's easy for a bad actor to add snippets into these large data sets unseen? Because when I've been talking to automakers, it seems like these are LLMs that then they highly customize. So in the VW demo I did, for instance, I was able to ask, what's the top seller of EVs? And it would say, you know, Tesla, let's say. But if I asked them, tell me why Tesla is amazing, it wouldn't answer the question. So that was VW's like fingers in that customized controlled environment. So maybe can you explain how it could be vulnerable or how a bad actor could get access to that and it would end up in a vehicle?
Sure. I mean, you raise a good question about whether or not car manufacturers are using open LLMs where, you know, they potentially are being updated and they have access to all the internet, as opposed to an in-house LLM that only it has carefully curated information. You know, what's interesting is if you're so carefully curating it, it's not clear what the real value is to the customer, right? If you can't, I mean, if you can only ask it five things, then why didn't you just, why have in the first place? In the case where you want to connect it to open LLMs. And indeed, like with CarPlay, I mean, you know, if you have it on your phone, it can come in through the car, right? So, I mean, there are other ways that you can access open LLMs without having to go through a OEM specific app. But there's two different ways that LLMs can be compromised. The first one is through the prompt. And so depending on how an LLM was set up and determining what the system prompt is, like what, you know, when a company trains an LLM, they train it on, you know, all this data, and then they give a system prompt, do not let people ask for, do not, do not, do not, do not. And so all this jailbreaking that you're seeing, you know, inevitably every day I wake up and there's some new hilarious jailbreak of some LLM. This is coming through, most of them are coming through the prompt, because you don't really have to have a lot of expertise. You just have to have kind of a curiosity and a willingness to sit down at a computer and start hammering out different statements and or combinations of letters and special characters to get something funny to happen or dangerous. There's another way, though. This is actually the more hidden, indirect way that turns out to be even more dangerous. And that is LLMs, because they're so brittle and they can't really do anything, for example, any math, they cannot do any math at all. They have to call another program to actually do the math. And so whether it's some kind of Python script or something, it will, when you ask it, for example, you could ask it, okay, how many miles, what's the shortest path from point A to point B? It would have to call Google Maps or something else to have to go get that information. And then once it told you that, and then you could say, okay, like take me there. But there's all this hacking that can go on at the interface between the Google app and the LLM. And that's far harder to detect. The people who do this are generally much more skilled, but the barrier to becoming skilled at LLMs is actually quite low. So that represents a clear vulnerability if you're having to pass information in and out for the LLM to fulfill its supposed, you know, capabilities.
Going back to the beginning where you were talking about potentially buying after your Ford Escape is done and replacing it for your child. If driving automation did not exist at all today, as we know it, and one were to redesign it and market it, productize it now based on first principles, like from scratch, like what would that look like? In my, it seems very clear to me that there's the failure of imagination for all the billions spent across automated driving in ADAS. There's absolutely no, there's virtually no in-car driver education, whether it's from the pre-ADAS era, but currently in the ADAS era, like how people are meant to understand what these systems can and can't do in car is, if it's an afterthought, it's not even an afterthought. Like OEMs will do the bare minimum or nothing. Is there a solution there, in car driver education?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's a solution, although it could be a mitigation for bad behavior. I worked a lot with Ford's human factors teams many years ago. It's one of the reasons I have a Ford, because I think they actually do a very good job and they're very thoughtful. And everything that they do is trying to get the human to things to be so obvious that the human doesn't need to actively have to learn anything, or if they do, it's actually so straightforward that it's, you know, it's not a perishable skill to remember, for example, how to operate your entertainment center. I am loath to try to resort to education because, you know, as a person who's done a lot of human factors over the years, at least in America, we just want to jump in our cars and go. And you know, the number of Tesla accidents that I've read and depositions and the driver, you know, did you even know that you could access your owner's manual through the car? No. Would you have accessed it if you knew? No. No. Well, where do you learn? I like to watch videos on the Tesla websites. Yeah. And so, I mean, that's just where we are. And so, you know, I mean, sadly, that's actually what I need to do with my own lectures. I just need to put them all on YouTube and retire. because nobody wants to do formal education anymore. Okay, but we've got to recognize that that's the case. I do think that it's been noted many times in many legal documents that Tesla does not have a human factors division. Indeed, they just got in a lot of trouble from NHTSA. NHTSA is asking very pointed questions about a lack of a human factors division. You know, they're not the only company. You know, the rise of LLMs is showing very clearly that companies are cutting corners on their, you know, human interaction with whatever technology, and that's going to bite them in the rear end. And it is. So I think that we do need to spend more time making sure that you're promoting affordances. That's a academic term where we talk about, you know, when you go pick up a coffee cup, you just go to pick up the handle. You don't have to, there was no thinking in your head. It was just so natural that there was a handle that you would pick it up, that that's how you did it. You know, that kind of affordance is what we need to work on in autonomous vehicles, especially. And, you know, the number of crashes that we're seeing where people do not understand, for example, when alarms go off, they can't hear them over the background noise. You know, there's just a lot of problems in the cars, I think, that would be solved if companies would take human factors seriously.
So I had one more question on thread. For many years, a 1973 Citroën SM. Have you ever driven this car?
I've ridden one. I don't know if you've ever driven one.
All Americans have driven a Citroën SM.
Well, Professor Cummings is a very unusual character and may have accessed all kinds of things. So this car had a hydropneumatic suspension and steering system that, for the uninitiated, was very, very assisted, and it was variable assistance based on speed. So at low speed, you could turn it lock to lock with like a finger. As a result, I crashed the car backing up at a parking lot into a pillar. And then I read the manual. And the manual stated it required like 50 or 60 hours of practice to use this to drive the car safely. And there was some discussion of the steering stuff. But what I really found amazing was that on the dashboard, layered onto the speedometer, were a braking distances to stop in feet, right underneath the speed, the mile per hour. And I was like, wow, that's really great. If only I could translate those distances into actually my eyes. I don't know what like 200 feet really looks like. But if only there was some form of automation or technology that could bring those warnings, like you're going too fast for the conditions. And yet it would seem very simple to put in new cars, not just AEB, which is not 100% foolproof, but some secondary system, supplemental system that would form like as you point out, a mitigatory driver education function. It would say, oh, you're going 70 and you cannot safely stop at these speeds and AEB can't guarantee to protect you. Why don't we see the simple little supplemental functionalities like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been after this AEB, I call it the maneuvering envelope, because you need these numbers presented to you in the car, because people don't realize that for a lot of manufacturers, that their AEBs are only guaranteed to work up to 45 miles an hour, you know, somewhere around there. And even then, the circumstances are quite limited. Yet, you know, crash after crash happens and people are like, well, why didn't my AEB go off? And you're like, 'cause you were nowhere in the window. And people don't read their owner's manual. So I think, yes, I think that's something we should do. And I think kind of going back to one of your earlier statements about what is wrong to automotive manufacturers, for many, many years, you know, most years, they tend to think that safety is not a value proposition, and that if we include all these safety features, we won't sell as many cars. And I think that, no, I think you would sell a lot more cars. People really value safety. I think we value safety more in today's world than we ever have, because, you know, I think people recognize that crashes have definitely not gone down. They're kind of holding steady right now. But, you know, I have a 17-year-old, she's a nightmare behind the wheel. I want, you know, as many, I'd put a big bubble around her driving on the car if I possibly could. So I do think we can monetize safety. And I think that, you know, the next big wave at some point, I think we're also hearing a lot that people don't want all these fancy tools and bells and whistles in their car, like the convenience automated driving, because they're tired. At the end of the day, you're so tired of whatever it is you're doing at work. You don't want to have to wrestle with your car to have a good driving experience. You just want to have a good driving experience without having to study a manual, without having to remember every bell and whistle that goes off in the car and what it means. And so I do think we're headed for a time where car manufacturers are going to be forced to go down that path, but it'll be interesting to see who the first one is that really adopts that. You would have think it would have been Volvo, but I don't know what journey they're on. They're on some other wacky journey.
So, you know, hopefully we are moving in the direction that you described, but like clearly for the last, I don't know, considerable time now, we've been in a world where people, where Autopilot has sort of, you know, specifically developed this market segment where I think people, you know, it's clearly sold under the illusion that it makes you safer. And I think people feel like, you know, I'm going to be on my phone anyway when I'm in my car, and this makes me feel safer doing it. And I think it taps into this general idea that if it's automated, it must be safer. And, you know, clearly there's another way of looking at it, which is, you know, data-driven, right? Like that's how safety really works, is it's data-driven. It's not a feeling of like, well, it's automated and it seems to be doing well and therefore it must be safer. And when you drill into the data, you know, clearly what Tesla has been, you know, the safety that Tesla has been selling it under is pretty misleading, the safety claim. You actually went to NHTSA to sort of, I won't say to do something about this. That was clearly how it was interpreted by the Tesla fans, that you were brought in to do something about Tesla specifically. But I'm curious, because I do 100% agree with you that there are major limits to what we can do educationally to address these issues. So what was your approach going to NHTSA in order to say, okay, we've got this world where people are buying these things that they think are safe, and clearly there's some challenges around that. How did you go about defining safety, and what were you doing for them?
Well, I think Alex is going to like this response. I was educating them. That was really, we might not be able to educate the drivers, but we can certainly educate the regulators. And indeed, you can see a lot of the stuff that I literally would teach class. I, you know, taught them all sorts of things about remote latency, communication signals, you know, what does it mean? How do you actually look at this data? How do you know when you collect all this data? Like, for example, for the SGO, how could we tell that there were problems with phantom braking? Where could I see that in the data? So that kind of thing. And, you know, so I was there to teach the teacher effectively, to help them gain the skill sets that they would need to be able to do what they're doing right now. And I'm, you know, they're moving faster than I thought they would move, but, you know, they're building the right skill sets and asking the right questions. And so, you know, I was there, it was my job to look at the standing general order results every day. So every day I read the NASCAR report of all the crashes that had happened before, the day before, everything on autopilot, everything in Silicon Valley, in San Francisco with Google and Waymo, et cetera, et cetera. After a year of doing that, I needed to take a break. I needed to go, because, you know, there's nothing like reading all these crashes. I am actually taking the bus a lot more than I ever have. I got to see all the data, and I was the first person to do any of the analysis on it to show them what they could learn from the data.
So, and it, just really quick, Kirsten, I got one more follow-up. You recently posted that, and it's interesting that you say this seems to be moving faster than you expected. And I suspect this is what Kirsten wants to dig into. I'm just curious, you posted, you said that this is a step, this is when the investigation came out and the recall query, this is a step towards the geofencing of autopilot. I just kind of want to untease why geofencing, because I think there's been so much focus on the driver monitoring piece of this, and less on the ODD piece, which NTSB way back in the first round of investigations focused on just as much as the driver monitoring. Why do you see geofencing as a likely sort of outcome for this?
So let me be clear that, you know, there are two ways. Well, no, there are three ways that geofencing with autopilot could happen. Number one, Tesla could just elect to do it, which is likely not to happen. Number two is NHTSA could make a rule that says you can, you know, you have to geofence. Or number three, which is the one I think that we're likely going to get, is that legislation is going to come down. A law will be passed that you have to geofence.
Okay.
And there's a lot of activity in this space right now. And so I do a lot of consulting for people on Capitol Hill. So I go up there all the time and talk to people about what's happening in the geofence world, and they want it.
So
is
so,
it the workaround? Go ahead, Ed.
Well, no, I'm just curious. So you're not saying that this is likely to be a remedy to the recall that NHTSA is going to order or whatever.
It might be.
And Tesla, so, it might be.
I would tell you there's one other piece of information that, like, the wild card in all this is what's going to happen with these lawsuits that are coming. There are several lawsuits that are pending. I am an expert witness on the Banner case, so we will see what happens with that one. But there's many, many others. I mean, I probably turn down a lawyer team a week who wants me to help them on a Tesla case. So it's substantial. And so depending on what happens in the courts could actually accelerate one or more of those paths. So, for example, if the Banner case goes to trial and all this information is divulged about what Tesla does know and wasn't telling its drivers, you know, if the public gets a hold of it, this information, the pressure could go either put more towards NHTSA, maybe the senators are going to want to take that for action, or maybe even Tesla will actually, you know, if there's an outcry, Tesla could actually step up and do the right thing and geofence the technology. So, you know, we'll see how that goes, because Tesla, you know, they said they would never settle these cases if they didn't think they were fair. But, you know, with the Walter Huang case, they settled. So it could be that they keep settling, and then that would take the legal pressure off.
You were talking earlier about how a lot of what you were doing at NHTSA was educating. And when I saw that you went over there, I went back to 2017. And I'm wondering if NHTSA kind of created some of the problems that we have today, because they put out a report at the time, if you recall, that was pretty controversial. I know that it definitely rankled Ed, but that said that Tesla's autopilot reduced crashes by 40%. And that statistic was used by Elon Musk and others for years. And it almost, at that point, became very difficult to argue any kind of regulation around it at all, because clearly it was saving lives. And the argument at the time was, well, if you prevent this from being in people's hands, you're killing people. It was like Elon flipped the script on that one. So when you got to NHTSA, was there acknowledgement that perhaps they were either just uneducated on how this really worked, or any sense of their role in what this has turned into, which to me is a much larger problem than it was before a federal agency basically said, they were essentially endorsing it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a problem in the transportation government agencies. It's going to be true across all different modes of transportation. And it's true regardless of whatever administration is in power. Regulators don't want to be seen as stopping innovation. And so there's been a tangible shift in the U.S. regulatory transportation structure, such that, you know, we want to make sure that we're enabling innovation. We don't want to get in the way of innovation. And I think that push to power innovation has actually tip the balance away from regulatory, what I would consider to be effective regulatory behaviors. And so, and that has a name, it's called regulatory capture, where agencies kind of can't decouple themselves from the companies they're regulating because they're in too tight. So I think that 2017 timeframe was really a good illustration of what regulatory capture looks like. But you have to put that in the context of where we were with technology and how much people loved the self-driving car idea, full self-driving. You know, everybody thought, oh, this is going to be great. It's coming. And, you know, I mean, Elon was only, what, two or three cycles into his, oh, you're going to get self-driving cars next year, as opposed to however many cycles we're into it now. So I do think, though, that there were people in NHTSA that understood where this was coming. And I don't think NHTSA gets very much credit for the standing general order. That happened before my time. So that was an incredible piece of, you know, legal work that had been done prior to my time. And because what it did is it really gave NHTSA the ability to get the data to really assess whether it was true that these claims. And the problem is because Tesla will not release the number of miles driven by any set of cars anywhere, it's impossible to actually check their work. But there are other ways that you can check the work. So, for example, I was able to take the crashes at the SGO from Tesla, and I was able to see, compared to other crash data sets, how dangerous were the crashes. And it was statistically significant. It was practically significant. If you were in a Tesla crash, you were at least two times, if not more, likely to either die or get fatally or seriously injured, as opposed to people not in a Tesla, right? So you were not safer, at least if you got into a crash. And one of the other things about these cars are you could actually see in the data, Tesla drivers, man, they all set their speeds. They put it on autopilot and then set the speeds at 9 miles over the speed limit. And, you know, the higher the speed, the more likely it is you're going to be either seriously injured or killed. And so the speed is the most likely contributor to the higher death counts if you're in a Tesla. So, I mean, that in that way, is it really a Tesla problem or is it really a driver problem or can you actually decouple these?
So I want to push back, like play devil's advocate for just a second, because this technology is actually, right, it's easy. It's not easy. You can sort of identify this is dangerous, but like, in regulation, right, like the challenge is often that you have to create a clear, consistently enforceable line. And to me, I think doing that without getting really prescriptive about technology seems quite hard. And I think particularly when you think about like driver monitoring. And so this is why I think it was interesting when you said, I think this is going to lead to autopilot being geofenced. Like I feel like geofencing, it would be sort of easier to create a clear, like consistent line around that and say your system has to be, you have to define your ODD, you have to develop for it, and you can't let it be used outside of it. Like that seems like something where you can create clear boundaries. I'm curious, with DMS, is that even possible? Is it possible to create a consistently enforceable standard for driver monitoring? Because that's been kind of my biggest question about the regulatory response for autopilot for a long time now.
Yeah, I think that's very tricky, and it's sticky for them, and because there's some issues with the technologies. And you know, I think it's a good question. Can you actually not only draw a clear line in the sand with rulemaking, but then can you have a test standard so that companies would know where they were against that test standard? And you know, I believe it's possible, although tricky. And then one of the issues that we know with the driver monitoring is, you know, if you use neural nets, which a lot of companies do, you know, these things are error prone, error ridden. You know, all you have to do is put on a fake pair of glasses and, you know, it's easy to trick these things. You know, in academia, there's just all these tricks that you can learn how to defeat neural nets. So I think that is a trickier rule to make. However, I also think that there could be ways around it, which are instead of making a rule that says, okay, you have to have a face monitoring camera and it has to meet these specifications, you could say you have to have at least two ways of monitoring the driver. And so, you know what I'm saying? So you could make it a little bit more straightforward, and you may not get the performance specs out of it that you would like, but you could get something. And indeed, the problems with the driver monitoring, I don't think people realize this is why we really struggle to do drunk driving detection using cameras, because the error rates are just too high. You know, you can't have your car lock you out from driving. And there would be at least probably a good 10 to 20% chance at any time you got in front of the car that, you know, if you were having to do some kind of state prediction, like drunk, not drunk, it just isn't reliable enough, right? So, you know, I think that kind of like where we are with full self-driving, it's not really working as advertised. Neither is driver monitoring if it requires camera vision to look at your face. That being said, you know, we're trying to promote innovation and we're hoping people can come up with at least more clever ways of sensor fusion to get at higher degrees of reliability.
But speaking of innovation, in case anyone forgot, I held until last 2 weeks ago the hands-off cannonball run record cross country in a Tesla set like in 2018, which I'm not saying was safe, but it sure was interesting. And last week, my record was broken by a guy in a Prius using a Kama AI device. And in order to verify that he was actually hands on or hands off, since the Prius didn't have any method of confirming his hands were on or off, and no OEM vehicle did that reliably, sewed together an electric jacket so that to close the loop when his hand touched the wheel or not. So he'd have incontrovertible proof that he was hands off driving cross country. But that's not what I want to ask you. So I know Professor Cummings is making a face. So
no, I think it's great. Like that's a great example of like put that guy to work, put that guy in Volvo, and let him come up with some new technique that would get us better than where we are now.
Something selling a DMS jacket might actually work for some brands. So here's my question: the Cruise incident from some months ago. I am asked frequently in my consulting work what I would need to see to believe that Cruise should be back on the road. And my answer is something that we've discussed in this show, which is they can't just follow the same playbook and just set the clock back. There has to be a spectacular demonstration of transparency and trust building. And that would include showing regulators, journalists, third parties, precisely how their remote guidance works, inviting people in to see the behind the scenes of that. Because no AV, no robotaxi company's ever done that. And Argo talked about doing that. We thought before we shut down, we would invite you were one of the people that was on my list to have come down and see precisely how it works. And no one's done that. And is there anything that, should Cruise cars be back on the road? And what would you want to see from them to give you faith that they should be allowed to test and deploy again?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And then there is a limit of what I can say because I'm actually also a consultant to the state of California and I'm actually making recommendations specifically on these points to them. So I'm not going to go into... Yeah, I'm not going to go into too much detail other than to say, you know, what I always say publicly is that the remote operations piece, it was a terrible thing that happened, but if there is a silver lining in that, the October 2nd, 2023 event, is that it really brought a lot of attention to a problem that I had been jumping up and down about for more than a year prior to that. And that is there's just no oversight of what's happening in the remote ops piece. I'm getting ready to release a very detailed analysis in a academic paper that's coming out soon. But it turns out Cruise actually did have a series of what I would have called great procedures. They published them in their safety report. But the problem is that the translation of the safety report to what they were actually doing in real time was these two things did not agree. And so I think I think that what's going to happen is Cruise, and this is what all the other companies have worried about, and indeed it's likely going to come true here, because if it doesn't happen in California, I'm working with people on Capitol Hill to make sure it happens in other states and maybe at the federal level, and that is regulation around remote operations. So right now there are no restrictions on where you can operate from. For example, you could have your remote operators in Kazakhstan, and they could be operating your vehicles in somewhere in the United States. So you're going to start seeing some rules/regulations/laws where the remote ops piece has to be in the same state where the vehicles are operating. They're going to have to professionalize the people. They're going to have to get licenses, special commercial licenses, and what the licensing behind that is going to be interesting. You know, people are looking at how to develop new licensing procedures. They're going to have to take drug tests, because right now you could be drunk and high and operate self-driving cars. And that's not illegal. So you're just going to start seeing a lot of oversight coming in. And this is typically what happens. You know, we got air traffic control in the 1950s because there was a ridiculous number of planes running into each other. So
that was exactly going to be my question, is do you see what's happening in the self-driving industry, which is very nascent, probably going to play out how we saw it play out with aviation in terms of the types of, like, even a specific agency dedicated on a federal level? I mean, will it get to that point? And we see that, you know, happening with eVTOLs. Like, it's actually quite hard to get the Type 2 certification to be able to, you know, fly. I'm wondering if you think the same thing's going to happen. Right. I'm not weighing in on whether it's good or bad. I'm just saying that, and I think it's good, but more, is that where you see things moving directionally? Because the remote assistance piece reminded me of air traffic control.
Yeah, I don't know about I doubt we're going to see a new federal agency like HTC, Highway Traffic Control, as opposed to ATC. And the reason because of that is the way that our surface transportation regulatory environment is structured is that the federal government oversees the technology, the FMVSS, for example, whereas states oversee driver licensing. And remote operators are drivers. And so I think that we will still leave it up to the individual states to develop their own licensing programs. But I'm also working with several bodies to start thinking about federal guidance for that, because it would be a bit heavy lift to ask 50 states to come up with individual tailored plans, whereas it would be good if they had a playbook, if you will, to pull from. And, you know, this is where the drug testing, you know, professionalizing the services, you know, standardizing training, who's getting what training, who's allowed what to operate. In the Cruise accident, you know, it was the fact that the car moved before the people in the command center got the video to see what happened. I mean, that wasn't supposed to happen per their safety guidelines, but that's what, you know, it's what did happen. So it just goes to show, I think, and this is true in aviation, is that dispatching and, you know, like, these are the things that get no money. They, you know, companies only spend the money on them if they have to. And so if you start to put that under some kind of regulatory environment, then they'll at least get a minimal and hopefully standard set of treatments.
I know we're almost out of time, but I got to ask, because
two critical questions.
Aviation, you can finish.
Let Ed get his question in, and then
this,
Alex.
This
can
comparison of aviation, I think I already know the answer to this, but I have to ask it anyway. You know, the FAA has a huge, like, much bigger budget than NHTSA does. I was kind of shocked to go and actually see how big that difference is. And I think one of the big differences, obviously there's innovation in aviation, but clearly, like, the kinds of new technologies that are out on the street in ground transportation, I mean, there's been like this massive explosion. The game has completely changed. There are things that you have to deal with or should be dealing with on a regulatory basis that you never would have even occurred to you, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. Certainly when funding last sort of changed in a dramatic way. My question is, having spent time at NHTSA explicitly to prepare them for this new world of new technologies that are already out on the road, how much is funding, like how much more funding does NHTSA need to sort of address, or to be able to even have a chance, I would ask to actually address and really properly regulate these new technologies?
You know, it's a complicated question because NHTSA could actually rebalance its portfolio, and, you know, they themselves could decide to put more money towards this. So I think in the near term, that would be a good thing for NHTSA to do. I do think that it would be better to have more money to look at the autonomous technologies, except that kind of stepping back and looking at not just NHTSA, but the Department of Transportation as a whole, is to say all the agencies need desperate help with wherever artificial intelligence is showing up. And so they do have a center for an excellent center for autonomy there, and it has tiny money. I actually think that probably instead of just giving NHTSA the money to do the AV, just the AV research, what they need is to really power this joint group that works across all the agencies, FAA, FRA, Federal Railroad Administration, NHTSA, you know, you've got the transit. I mean, all of them are in desperate need. And so I feel like we need to inflate one group so that they can serve as advisors to the other transportation units.
Go ahead, Alex.
Well, since we're out of time, I'm just going to ask, my final question would be, how many years back has Lex Fridman set safety by persisting in making the claims and that he's made without walking them back? You can
do
pick,
people
you can
still
say no comment. Oh yeah. You can pick a number or no comment.
I'm going to go with Kirsten here. Like, nobody listens to him anymore. Like, I mean, I guess he had his time in the sun, but like, I don't hear no one in the circles that I walk. No one ever talks about him. So, I mean, I guess maybe he's still doing interviews, but you know, I'd rather be making history than interviewing people who are making history. So, you know,
I think he's more focused on ayahuasca and like world, like so, like ending the Ukraine war or something.
I don't know.
These days,
that's your last question, Alex. That's how you're ending. That's how you're going to end. That was a low note.
I'm about to get in a Waymo with a booster seat and take Coco to school. So I got to go. But I hope it was great to talk to you, Professor. And as always, you are essential.
Well, thanks for having me. Anytime.